Hello, and welcome to the Full Circle Healing Podcast, where we merge modern cutting-edge science with traditional healing wisdom and everything in between to help you come full circle back to your original natural state of health and well-being. I'm your host, Michael, and over the last 15 years, I've helped hundreds of thousands of people find the information, practices, tools, resources, and experts they needed to find their way back to optimal health. Our guest in this episode is my family's own doctor, who's become a friend, the incomparable Dr. Eric Gordon. Dr. Gordon is the medical director of Gordon Medical Associates in the San Francisco Bay Area. In addition to 40-plus years of clinical practice, Dr. Gordon is a consulting expert and engaged in clinical research. He's worked with Dr. Robert Navio, who's done research into metabolomics, mitochondrial function, and chronic inflammatory disease. In 2016, Dr. Gordon was co-author with Dr. Navio on a groundbreaking study, Metabolic Features of Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. He is one of the go-to experts in the world for complex chronic illness such as Lyme disease, chronic fatigue syndrome, mast cell activation syndrome, long COVID. So in this completely loaded episode, we continue the conversation started in part one, which you definitely don't have to listen to first in order to find value here. Today, you're going to be learning how chronic illness is often less about the initial trigger and more about how each person's unique biology responds to the trigger, the importance of addressing musculoskeletal imbalances such as cervical spine alignment, fascia fluidity, and the diaphragm in working with chronic illness, and it's often missed, how chronic infections like long COVID, Lyme, or Epstein-Barr can and do silently drive seemingly unrelated chronic symptoms and conditions, and how whole body thinking integrates bodywork, immune modulation, and emotional healing to address complex chronic illness, and a ton more. This is probably the most loaded episode we've ever had of Full Circle Healing. Dr. Gordon could have gone for another hour or two or three, so maybe we'll have a part three someday. It's always tons of fun to talk to him. I learned so much, and we cover like dozens of topics in an hour. So if you want to hear a wide range of super valuable health information from one of the biggest fire hoses of experience that's out there, with clinical experience and research experience and working with the most complex chronically ill people, this is it. So enough from me. Let's jump into it with Dr. Gordon. And we are back. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Gordon.
So good to be with you. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's fun. And this is the first part two of the new podcast. So you're the first guest that's been back to record a part two, because we just weren't done yet and there was more to talk about. And I kind of went over just now in the intro a few of the things that we went over. And today we are going to start with a topic that was not planned, that came up while we were talking before we went on air, that you've kind of taken a little bit of a deeper dive or been exposed to a little bit more information around the aftermath from COVID and long COVID, and what you are seeing in your clinic, which, for those who don't know, at Gordon Medical, a lot of their patients have seen, I don't know what the average is number of doctors, but a lot of doctors, they have a lot of complex chronic illness. It's probably one of the places in the U.S. that the patient demographic is the most complicated and complex. And you have a lot of people around you who have taken dives into COVID, and some of that by osmosis has been absorbed. And so what are, you used a term, twists the body, that COVID is an infection or a bug that twists the body. I guess we could start there and kind of explain what you mean by that.
Yeah. Well, what we're seeing, okay, is the changes in the immune system, and as you were mentioning, in the physiology, not just the immune system, because what we had seen before COVID were people who've been sick sometimes for decades, you know, and we could get them back to, you know, 80, 90, even sometimes 100%, but, you know, usually at least 70, 80% back to, you know, where they, you know, their previous health. And since COVID, it's been harder. And it's something that we are not really a long COVID. You know, people don't come to us that much for long COVID. It's still more the chronic infections, the mast cell and all that stuff. But things have changed, okay? We are just seeing that the, for instance, the mast cell or, you know, the dysautonomia, you know, which used to respond to, you know, treating, you know, treating the bug, removing the toxins, you know, detoxing the body, you know, just generally improving the overall health of the person, you know, people would, you know, that spiral up towards to back to health and resiliency is just harder to do in the last 4 years. It looks like that as your friend, you mentioned another doctor, another practitioner that you work, that you interview and have worked with, that there really is, you know, not just vascular damage, but sometimes damage to the organ or some of the organs, and especially, I think, in the brainstem, that we were not seeing that often, okay? A lot of dysautonomia in the past was easier to deal with. You know, again, and I brought up, as our last conversation, we talked a lot about structure, and we would see a lot of people who, the most difficult dysautonomia people are the ones with the really severe CCIs, where the cranial cervical junction, where the head sits on the neck, is now off a little bit. And you start to see persistent dysautonomias that are hard to deal with, or mast cells that are hard to deal with, because, you know, we always, I mean, we think of the vagus, and I'm sure there's many more pieces to that. But just simplistically, the dorsal vagal nuclei are irritated, and they really have a lot to do with when that's not happy with keeping your immune system on this hyper alert state. And since your mast cells are an integral part of the innate immune system, and they are ubiquitous. You know, you have these little mast cells are all around your nerves, you know, all around the organs. They're just about everywhere. Well, so dysautonomia is when your, what we call your autonomic nervous system, the thing that controls your, you know, your blood pressure, your heart rate, your gut function, your bladder function, your gut function, all in the background. I mean, that's basically, this is your software that—
All the stuff that's happening that you're not doing.
That you're generally not thinking about. Unless you're a yogi or really doing a lot of work, you're not having much effect day to day on your autonomic nervous system. It's running in the background, you know. And that system, when there's an inflammation in the body, begins to not function as well. And mast cells can, because they create local inflammation around the nerves, will, and then, you know, the autonomic nervous system is the nervous system, and it's the head of it is the vagus nerve. When that's irritated and not, and the signals coming back from your organs are being amplified, then your body doesn't work well. You know, then you get up, you stand up, you get dizzy, you walk across the room, and your heart rate's hitting 110, 130 sometimes, or even higher, for minimal activity. You know, you're not out there, you know, doing a 6 minute or 8 minute mile. You're like, you know, shuffling slowly to the bathroom, and your pulse is racing, and that leaves you fatigued, tired, exhausted. That
you
is
said physical. You said a physical structural issue, because I don't think a lot of people look there. I think that gets overlooked, even within the functional medicine space. You're saying there's a structural issue in the cervical.
Yeah, usually it's, you know, we all come with like different shapes and sizes and structure. Okay, but the ligaments hold us together. Okay. And the ligaments go from bone to bone, basically. You know, tendons go from bone to a muscle, and ligaments go from bone to bone. And when those ligaments get a little lax, okay, they can allow more movement in the area. And if that movement puts your bones and your muscles into a different position, that can stress the nerves and the blood vessels, you know. So it's one of those things that once the, you know, it's like all circles in medicine, you know, like we always start from one thing and go, this causes that. And the reality is that in some people, you know, perhaps the the nerve irritation is the biggest issue. And in some people, it's the muscular tension that then arises to compensate for that causes the biggest issue. But it all is happening simultaneously. You know, that I think that's the most important thing to understand about the body is that, you know, it's all a circle. You know, your glutathione and your antioxidants and blah, blah, blah. Everything is a circle. And sometimes, you know, if you fix the right part of the circle, things get better. But you have to remember that it's a circle. Otherwise, you get frustrated because, like, you know, you'll do your best in some patients to, you know, get the oxidized and reduced glutathione back in balance, you know, or, you know, people. Yeah, I was going to give more examples, but it'll just be confusing. So just stick to that one, you know. But in other people, it's other antioxidants or just the local blood flow to an organ that's off that's stressing you, you know. So it's finding out what's stressing you. And so, you know, just because, you know, one person started, you know, fixing up their glutathione and they got all better. Well, wonderful. But other people, their glutathione system can be fine.
That's when their doctor writes a book saying that fixing somebody's glutathione level will fix every person.
Exactly. And the thing we have to remember, those are good things because people who do deep dives on one piece teach us all about that piece. You know, the great example is, you know, is the mast cell world or the mold world or the mycotoxin, you know, I mean, or the SIBO and GI things. I mean, there are some people you help them rebalance their gut.
Yeah.
And everything else gets better.
But without the deep divers who really go in that one lane,
we don't know.
It would be really difficult for everybody else to.
Yeah,
to know.
Right, no, because, I mean, that's why, you know, you do what you do and I do what I do, which is talk to smart people. Because, and the best is to find smart, directed people. And then you have folks like us with a little ADD who, like, want to learn everything, you know. Yeah. And we never can learn it at the depth that the people who go full-time into one aspect.
There's no way I could jump that deep into one subject.
Well, I wish I could.
And I find it more interesting to know a little bit about a lot of things to start to see the web of them, just personally. But I'm glad that there's those almost obsessive individuals who are like, I have to know how this thing works.
Yeah, no.
And then they can come back and we can learn from them. And then I also learned how that thing works from that person and, oh, this thing and that thing work together. But it's like the specialization, right, of Western medicine too. Like they go down these silos of the cardiologist never talks to the neurologist who never talks to the gastroenterologist. But if I have like a block in my intestine, I really want that gastroenterologist to come.
Yeah, tell me about it. Right.
Tell me how to fix it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, and it luckily, you know, we have such diversity of minds. I mean, I think that's, I think we both honor that like without these people who can be frustrating sometimes because, you know, that old saying, you know, to a hammer, everything is a nail is can be frustrating to the patient, you know, because we see that most of our patients that we get are people who've seen experts in one of these areas. And, you know, and I learned a tremendous amount, like when people go see Dr. Afrin, you know, the mast cell maven, I call him the mast cell maven, I learned a tremendous amount. His reports are amazing. You know, Larry is just a just brilliant. And, but he knows details about mast cells and about how, for instance, I'm just a little throw out here, something that I never, ever would have had the patience to figure out. But, you know, there are people who are so sensitive that, you know, they'll take something that's a compounded supplement or medicine and they react. And yet they can take others and don't. And it turns out that the common factor is methylcellulose, which most people consider, you know, next to inert. But methylcellulose is cellulose, but it can come from different.
It's the stuff they make the capsules out of, right?
Yeah. This is the filler. You know, like if you have something like, you know, that's a few micrograms of active stuff, in order to get it into the capsule, you got to mix it with something to fill up the capsule. And so that's usually the most common thing is methylcellulose. And most people do fine with it, but you run into a few folks who, you know, they react. And, you know, you think they're reacting to the to the medicine and what, you know, and they may be, but often they can be reacting to the methylcellulose. And what's weird, or not weird, but very frustrating, is it turns out that there are, I mean, again, this is only some people. Most people, methylcellulose is fine. It doesn't matter if it comes from a bamboo plant or a palm tree or a, any kind of, you know, plant source. But there are some people who the different plant sources, even though we think we've removed all the proteins and everything, they'll react to them. And they have to find a compounding pharmacy that can keep going back and getting them the same source of the methylcellulose. I mean, but that's a level of detail that I would have never realized on my own, you know? I mean, and it's that, that's the beauty of the experts, you know, I mean, I mean, just going back, you know, for a lot of people, you know, Dr. Shoemaker is a good example of where, you know, his deep dive on the innate immune system early in the 2000s, when nobody else was paying much attention, you know, really, I think has led the field forward. I think that the problem is that he has developed a system that he teaches that is good, but is it only applies to some people, you know, like the whole Sears, the whole chronic inflammatory response syndrome. Well, that is applies to everybody, but his take on it is still a little narrow. You know, it doesn't include the whole world. It doesn't include every variable that can be in there. And so that goes back to these, you know, we do stand on the shoulders of giants, as they say, of people who really go deep and lead us forward. But for the patient, it's important to remember that if you're working with one of those people and it's not working for you, it's not that they're wrong. They're just missing a component that is in you. again, they're missing a piece of the circle. They're trying to enter in, you know, like, okay, we're going to fix these chemicals or we're going to fix this organ system, you know, like just like the SIBO people, you know, brilliant, wonderful ideas. But sometimes, that's the wrong place to start for that person. Or not the wrong place to start, but the wrong place to finish, you know, because there are other, I mean, so going back, if your vagus nerve isn't happy, okay, you're going to have a real hard time changing your gut flora to get it healthy again. Okay. Because the, you know, even though 80% of the information to your vagus nerve from your, is coming from your gut, but that 20% that comes from the vagus is real important, and it will change the milieu, and that changes all the innate immune stuff that's happening in your gut, which is endless. You know, and immunology is a, is this you know, the Sargosa Sea of medical knowledge. I mean, nobody can understand immunology as a whole anymore. I mean, like, there's a lot of people who do a very good job, but we have
it's
so
the topic that glazes my brain over the quickest.
Well, my problem, I mean, me too, because there are so many different subsets of immune cells. You know, I mean, they keep finding different subsets of T, you know, different subsets. You know, first we thought TH1, TH2, then TH17 and Tregs, but each one of those sets have different subsets. And, you know, so you luckily, the body lets us be kind of not be so precise, and people, because the inherent healing drive of the system is strong enough that we don't have to get everything right. You know, I always tell people when I was a kid, I was a car mechanic for a very short period of time. And the problem with cars is if you don't get it right, it doesn't work well. The wonderful thing about people is you just got to get close. You know, you, even if you get the screw halfway in,
got to get it like a little more right than it is.
And then it fixes itself. You know, you don't have to know every detail.
I want to slow down there because I want people to hear that, because you're not the first one who has said some variation of that, either on a podcast or a masterclass or something else I'm recording, is that our body inherently heals itself. Like our inherent state is one of like healing and regeneration, or the baseline. If you can remove all the stuff that's pulling it out of that, whether it's an infection or toxins or a neck issue that's pinching a nerve or a stress externally or a et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the more of those things you can remove, right? The body will fix itself. Like, it's designed to fix itself. We don't have to fix it. Like, you don't fix someone, you don't fix your patient's body. It does it itself, right?
Yeah. And what's fascinating is that you don't know which thing is going to move the needle. You know, we'll jump for a minute for a little odd piece of biochemistry that I just want to let everybody know. Anytime I speak about biochemistry, forgive me if my details are not perfect. It's like immunology. It's another area that is so immense and unknown that it's easy to mess up on. But that being said, I've been working with another Michael McAvoy,
who Michael quite well. That's how we met each other.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Right.
He introduced me to you when Mira, my wife, was really sick and we were looking for an MD to work with. And Michael is brilliant and he has a relatively strong disdain for the medical system. And so he said, well, I got one really smart MD I can introduce you to, and I think he'd be a good fit. Here's his email. Email him. And that was
that was the history. And, you know, and Michael and I have known each other for a long time, but we struggled with how to work together, you know, in the past, because it's, his depth of knowledge and his ability to see connections was phenomenal, but it didn't always fit my patients, but because their systems were broken at levels that didn't allow the biochemistry that he could see that was off to still get repaired with the supplement and with the supplemental approach. But we've learned to dance together and, find the place. He'll come up and we'll talk about a patient, we'll review their labs, and he'll tell me five or six different pathways that he thinks if we supported them with this or that would make a difference. And, but what I find is that often only one or two of those things are really applicable to that person, but when I hit it, it really can make a big difference. And that's the frustrating thing, I think, for patients to understand and other practitioners, is that we have broad concepts that really are helpful. Clean up the gut, remove the toxins, help the detox system work, restore the energy system as best we can,
circadian balance.
Yeah. Take care of the body, feed it, give it the right exposure to the world, to nature, and all that stuff. That's all critically important. But more frequently than I like, it turns out that there's one little thing that even after you've done all that, one thing we're playing with is molybdenum, because it tends to help in the body's ability to metabolize aldehydes. Aldehydes the simplest way to think about aldehydes. When you metabolize fats, you wind up with an aldehyde. But when you metabolize alcohol, you wind up with an aldehyde. And so that's what started us off, because a lot of our patients have that wake up in the morning hungover feeling. They're just foggy, and some of that foggy feeling stays throughout the day. And I always had a strong sense that it had to do with their overnight metabolism. At night you're basically cleaning up the system, cleaning out the garbage. And it seemed these people woke up with a full garbage bin. They just couldn't, they didn't finish the job. They broke down enough chemicals to kind of start cleaning, except the chemicals that were left behind were still affecting their brains, so they woke up kind of not thinking clearly and not feeling well. And, this doesn't go for everybody, but we find that some of these people, especially the ones who tell you that they used to be able to have a drink and now alcohol is really, they can't do it. As soon as they have a drink, they're in trouble. So we started realizing that, well, maybe they have trouble metabolizing their aldehydes. And, it's a whole bunch of things we can use, but a really important trace mineral in this is the molybdenum, which we don't think about too much, and for some people I'm fine, you know, who have that feeling, and everything else is a lot better. Molybdenum kind of like wakes up their brain. You know, it just helps for those, and but it's not for everybody. You know, I mean, you give it for 10 people, and maybe 2 people respond. And this goes back to a point that I always think that it just pains me in medicine, is that we do medicine based on these double-blind placebo-controlled trials, where if something has a 20 or 30% effect, up in the past, we just threw that away. We decided that was either placebo or just too common. Medicine just said, oh. And that's true. If you're giving somebody a drug that has a, you know, 20 or 30% chance of making people sicker or hurt them, well, then, yeah, you don't want to use something that has a 20, 30% of hurting, like, so, you know, 3 people.
Yeah, but if it's something that doesn't have a chance to hurt anybody, 20 or 30% is a decent
is very good
swing, right? Yeah.
Exactly. So your percentage of success, you know, like something is valuable if you give it to that person who's in the 20 or 30%, as long as it's not something that has just the biggest chance of doing damage to them. I mean, that is the
so the way I'm understanding this is that that there's these broad, we'll call them actions or recommendations or practices that would apply to pretty much anyone, whether they're sick or not, whether they are at baseline and they want to optimize themselves or become more resilient. There's all these things that, yes, this is probably a good idea, and it's really easy to predict what these things are, and all of these things are really helpful. Do these things. The more deep you get into the biochemistry and the further you go into the immune system and the biochemistry and these kind of things, when people have these complex storms of symptoms and conditions and infections and diseases and diagnoses, then you can identify a whole bunch of things that are probably off here, and we're not sure. Then it becomes more of a game of hit or miss, more a game of try this, which is really frustrating for people to hear, because everyone wants there to be this, look at all my things, tell me what's wrong with me, give me the things to do, then I'm going to be better. And you need to be able to tell what those things are. What you're saying is the deeper in the weeds that you get with complex systems, there's going to be some trial and error. There's things we don't understand. There's stuff that's going to help Bob, but not Larry, who have the same biochemistry on their test. And that people need to understand this, like that it's helpful for a patient to understand this, right? Like it helps with the mental aspect of going through this to understand this concept.
Absolutely, because it goes back to, you know, I forget who's it. I always have to apologize. My ability to recall names was never good, and it's terrible these days. But I can't remember the biochemist who actually won 2 Nobel Prizes. One of them he discovered was folic acid. But anyway, you know, this, I mean, and Pauling, you know, and Linus Pauling, biochemical individuality, you know, we are incredibly different. Even identical twins can be significantly different in their biochemistry. And and that usually doesn't matter. Okay. But it does when you get chronically ill. It does, because, you know, I think I've said this before to you, but it, you know, acute illness is about the thing that made you sick. Chronic illness is about you. Okay.
Yeah.
The triggers are still may still be important if they're still there. You know, if the bullet's still there, well, maybe taking it out and, you know, and it'll be a good idea.
This is kind of looping us back to what we were talking about at the beginning about COVID. Is like a lot what you were saying then is that a lot of these triggers or illnesses, these acute illnesses, they become chronic, like the infection's still there, the bug's still there, it's still causing damage. And for what you've seen with a lot of these long-term infections is if you deal with the bug and you clean it up and you get the bug out of there and you get then the immune system will calm down and then somebody feels a lot better. But what you're saying with COVID is that COVID comes along, get rid of the bug, and there's this
possible. I mean, the thing about COVID that's, I mean, like, it's
hold on, Sir Frederick Gowland Hopkins.
What was that?
British biochemist who received the 1929 Nobel Prize for physiology.
Sven Georgi.
Okay.
Sven Georgi, who is like just a brilliant scientist. I mean, like all great scientists, you know, I mean, that's just been a good scientist or an okay scientist and a great scientist is great scientists or very good ones always know, believe their data, not their theory. You know, and that's another rabbit hole we can talk about is that that's one of the biggest problems in medicine today is because there's so much money behind a theory that even when the data doesn't fit, you keep, I mean, you know, Alzheimer's is a great
Alzheimer's
example.
With the brain plaque for decades, you know, and billions of dollars.
Years and billions of dollars. and you have all these people whose careers are hooked into finding, you know, how to get rid of plaque when that's not the problem, is preventing because the data was clear that it wasn't working, but they were so deep in it that they couldn't change their minds. And that's crappy science, but that's what happens when it's driven all by money, you know, and our current, but okay, we won't go.
Right, let's go back. We were talking about when COVID's gone, it leaves aftermath that's uncommon with infections.
Right. And see, what makes COVID even more confusing is how much is it totally gone? Okay, because we keep finding, I mean, one of the things that I'm finding, and I think many, many people are, it's written about a lot, even in the mainstream literature, is some people remain spike protein factories, you know, and so are they still, do they have COVID still living in their guts or other organs, you know, at very low levels? You know, this goes back, I mean, you know, to Dr. Chia, who like 25 years ago or so started with the idea that enteroviruses were causing chronic fatigue. And nobody really paid him much attention because, you know, enteroviruses are either A, supposed to be gone or not supposed to cause big trouble. You know, RNA viruses, we always thought like, you know, disappeared. They went away. You know, DNA viruses could get into our cells and keep, you know, hiding us. But these RNA viruses, we're not supposed to do that. Oops. Looks like they do. You know, so there are people who still have persistent virus probably, but a lot of people looks like have just persistent or have damaged the endovascular lining of blood vessels and the severe cases, you know, that were first noticed were the people who, you know, had damage to their lungs that were permanent and damage to the heart, you know, with COVID. But what we're seeing now is a lot of people who didn't have this severe damage have low level dysfunction, and especially affecting the vascular and probably the brain. And that's really, you know, what makes a lot of it difficult. And especially if that, you know, if it affects the brainstem, which is the lower part of the brain that basically controls all that autonomic function, you know, and that's where, there's a lot of work, you know, and it's these circles of like you fix one piece, but if you don't realize the other piece is important, you know, just like you know, like you have a lot of neurologic chiropractors who do phenomenal work at, you know, rebalancing, you know, trying to get habit patterns in the brain to unwind. And they also, a lot of them are working with supplements to try to lower inflammation. But sometimes you got to like kill the bug, you know, or you can do that till the cows come home and people will have these amazing, they'll feel better in the office. But, you know, within hours or days, they're back again because there's something, like I said, that persistent infection that's causing the problem. And we're going to take a little turn here for a minute, Michael. Allow me.
I'm shocked.
Okay. No, because this is something I've been thinking about a lot lately. Is so much, I believe, I'm a big believer that persistent low-level inflammation is behind most of, we'll call it degenerative aging, if you will, because I do think there are people who actually manage to live quite well, quite long, and they die just because the system, you know, they die when they're 90 or 100. And, you know, they don't have significant heart disease. Their kidney function is still fairly normal. You know, there's that, you know, they say about 10% loss of organ function over decades after 30. But, you know, there are people who, lots of people who have lived, who have come with the right genes, first of all, and who've lived, you know, healthy lives. Everything looks pretty good. But then there is a lot of us, I'm one of them, who, as we live, the organs start to not do so well. You know, kidney function goes down. You have atherosclerosis, you know, significant, you know, calcium deposits in your heart. And that is a function of chronic inflammation. And what people, I don't think, are totally understanding, is that a lot of the scientists think this is quote unquote sterile inflammation or just like autoimmunity. And I think that's a concept to me that I have trouble with, because I don't think that really, I don't want to say it doesn't exist because that's too strong of a statement, but I think it's far from the main player. The main player is this low level chronic inflammation that your body, your immune system can adjust to, but it's damaging, okay? Because, I mean, atherosclerosis, cholesterol goes to where there's inflammation. You know, that's why it goes in those blood vessels. It goes into your mitochondria when they're not doing so well. Otherwise, there's no cholesterol really in the membrane of mitochondria, you know, and there's not a lot of it in your normal cells.
So it goes when there's damage or it's not working properly.
Yeah, when there's inflammation. It follows. I mean, that's inflammation is the breadcrumbs of the body. Okay, you know. I mean, that tells your the cell when your cell starts to put out inflammatory signals, which we might have talked about past a little bit. That extracellular ATP is kind of like, at least in one story, the one I happen to like from Dr. Navio, Dr. Robert Navio, is that this extracellular ATP is the first flag that a cell waves when it's having an issue is it increases the extracellular ATP and other purines, other breakdown products of ATP on the cell surface, and this signals a little bit of distress. Now, a low level is part of normal function. Okay. A low level of ATP on the surface of the cell gets other receptors to upregulate. I mean, that's how we learn. That's how we know that, stay away from that scary thing, is because we pay attention. And attention is inflammation. I mean, which is really an interesting way to think about it, because the extracellular ATP has increased a tiny bit. This is like a very, very, a very big gradation. You know, people who can't be exposed to anything, their cells have been producing so much extra ATP that after a while, to not exhaust the system, the receptors become so upregulated that any signal is overread. But getting back to chronic inflammation, because I said I have more and more people through actually long COVID, but and just friends and things. I get more and more people who come who want to talk to me about health optimization, okay, which I've never liked in the past, because until the last 10 years or so, when our ability to measure biochemical stuff and genetic stuff hasn't gotten to the point where we can begin to see in overtly healthy people what needs support, I never was comfortable with health optimization, because if you come to me as a 40 or 50 year old and want to know what the best thing to do for you, well, you know, I said, other than, you know, exercise, be in nature, open your heart a little bit, you know, what supplement to take? I never could tell, because, you know, it was that same thing. Healthy people, how do you know when your CoQ10 made you feel better? You know, maybe you will, but I just didn't like it. Sick people, it was clear they had symptoms. When their symptoms improved, I knew I was in the right track. But I didn't want to put people on 20 supplements to take for the rest of their lives that, you know, 18 of them didn't do anything for them. But as we've gotten genetics and the better ways of looking at the innate immune system and subsets of immune function, even 40, 50-year-olds, we can begin to aim them better. I mean, even younger people probably, you know, using the genetic information. But so that goes back to this idea of chronic inflammation. And I said it, I am a card-carrying example. I am in my 70s and I work constantly. I can do anything I want to do. I can, you know, I can keep up with 40 and 50-year-olds, which is what I do. Everybody I'm with is in that age group. But I have significant atherosclerosis, okay? My kidney function isn't great. And the other part about me is I don't take care of myself the way I tell my patients to. I mean, other than my lifestyle is good, but I'm terrible at doing any IVs or taking supplements on any kind of regular basis. But I also found that I have, you know, low level infections. You know, I had Bartonella about 15 years ago. I had tick bite, Bartonella, treated it, would come back, finally treated it aggressively with IV antibiotics for a few months and went away. The symptoms were gone, felt fine. I still feel fine, but I just did a fish is a fluorescent antibody that is for a part of the protein of the bug. So it's not an antibody test. Okay. It's not looking for my immune response. It's looking for the bug. And so the bug's still there. And I mean, it's one of probably many that my immune system keeps the overt symptoms down, but the cost is that my inflammation in my body, my immune cells are a little hyperactive. They're making more noise than they should. Okay.
Which is subclinical and not really a thing until it isn't.
Right. That's the point. And I have I think that a lot of people who think they're healthy have chronic infections that and this is what makes it so hard. Is that how many people do you treat? I mean, you know, in the Lyme world, what we always saw is the family would come in, you know, and like the mom and the two kids would be sick. And then there would be the father and maybe another sibling would be absolutely fine. And, you know, we would check everybody. And, you know, the father and the healthy sibling had the same immune, you know, the same tested positive for the bug. You know, but they were fine. And I always used to, and I still debate to this day how much to do. You know, I mean, like, I feel comfortable treating them herbally. I don't feel comfortable giving people something like an antibiotic, which, like we talked before, is that it might have a 20% chance of really helping you, but it also has a probably a 50 or 80% chance of screwing up your, or, you know, a higher chance of screwing up your gut and maybe cause more long-term problems. So, you know, it's always been a difficult thing. But as I'm looking at myself and other health, quote unquote, healthy people, I'm realizing there's a lot of this out there. Okay. And we see it with, you know, with the tick-borne infections. We see it with cytomegalovirus and EBV and HH6 and obviously our new friend COVID, you know. But I'm sure that this is driving a lot of early heart disease and kidney failure and, you know, diabetes and, you know, all these things where your immune system is slightly upregulated, you know, not on a regular CBC, you look fine. You know, my white blood cell count isn't high. My CRP has been undetectable or 0.1 forever. You know, I don't have any of those overt things. Mm-hmm. I have chronic inflammation. You know, if I look further at some other innate immune system things, I see little, you know, things are a little higher than they should be. And this is, I go back to that, this is probably, you know, evolutionarily good because I don't get sick much, you know, and if I do get, I don't get sick. I've never been really sick in my life, you know, significantly. But on the other hand, my immune system is so hyper that if I do get sick and don't hit it hard, like if I get a cold and don't do IV vitamin C, if I just like, oh, I'm not, yeah, I feel kind of crappy for a day and then I'm pretty much better. but I'm not all better. It takes about 2 or 3 weeks till that little bit of fatigue, that little bit of waking up and feeling like you're not right, to go away in me, because I have an aggressive immune system. You know, I mean, it's like, luckily I'm not an angry person, I'm not overtly angry person, because I would probably be real pain in the butt, you know, because it's that kind of reactivity that, you know, in the personality level, that is a difficult person. And I have a probably, but you know, the thing about angry people is they often get what they want. You know, there's a trade-off in life. You know, being a super nice guy is cool, but you often get, you know, taken advantage of and knocked around. Well, it's the same thing in the immune system. But anyway, I know that as above, so below, I think is really true. And on all levels. But anyway, so low level chronic inflammation, I think, is driving a lot. And that's the danger of COVID, is because I think it's a new driver of this persistent low level inflammation that is, and we're still stumbling with, because I don't think we're paying enough attention to how many people have persistent spike protein. You know, I mean, like I measure, and I don't know if it's, I mean, there is some labs in Germany, and but we, in America, the best I can do is really just measure spike protein over time. You know, like the, you know, because I measure the spike and the N protein at the same time, because if somebody had COVID, there should be an antibody to the N protein as well, as that's part of the spike thing. But just the spike itself, if that's there without the N protein, then you're probably just making spike protein, you know, and you haven't stopped. And I don't quite understand what's going on, you know, why those antibody levels don't go away, you know. Do you just have low level COVID living in your cells? I don't know. And then we have the same issue with the EBV, you know. The PCRs are negative. But
that's Epstein-Barr virus, yeah.
Barr virus, you know, I mean, like an HH6. And because these are supposed to stay in us, you know, they low levels, you see, because the thing, low level infection is how our body learns. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a bad thing. That's, you know, but it's how your immune system is able to respond to that. So this is a long story. And what does this all mean? It means you have to pay attention to your own system. You can't just go to the doctor and say, you know, your blood count is normal and you're done. You have to, I think, work with people who are trying to look deeper. And this is not a field that I can tell you, well, do this test, that test, and that test, and we know for sure, because the issue I have with a lot of the testing that is in the alternative or functional medicine community is that it's not well validated. Mm-hmm. Okay. They often run these tests on, like, you know, 20 controls or 10 controls or 50 controls, and then they just start charging money to do the test. And you really need 1,000 people to know,
to validate, like, the clinical relevance of the
clinical
results.
Relevance of these, yeah, things. Yes, yes. You know, I mean, like, we just don't do enough, because,
like, sure, it tells me this, but does this matter?
Does this matter? Because you see, all these tests are CLIA approved in America, but CLIA just means that the test is measuring what it says it's measuring. Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's good. So it's really...
It doesn't say if what it's measuring matters, though.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, and the thing is, the FDA is trying to get in the middle of this and that would be deadly unless...
That's not
going to
go...
That's not going to go well. Yeah, that's not going to go well. But we have to get somewhere in the middle. You know, what we want, we want the FDA to just be an umpire. That would be nice, you know.
So if it did its job, like if it did the thing it's there to do.
Right.
Like, and we're talking about it as some like absurd fantasy like situation. But really, we're just asking that it does the thing that it's supposed to do.
Yeah,
in which is, not overstepping, yet making sure things are valid and relevant and safe.
Yeah. but not demanding levels of proof that only big pharma can afford. I mean, that's the problem. Is they say they you know, yes, it might cost you an extra $100,000 to validate this. Okay, but if you're a lab, you got a good test, you can afford that, or you will be able to afford that. But you can do it if it's going to be $100 million.
No.
Yeah. You know, that's not
happening. Yeah, unfortunately, if I had to wager, that's the direction I would bet on them going. But
well, that's how they've gone, and I'm hoping, that maybe we'll have a little course correct on that, because it's crucial. You know, this goes back to, you know, just the whole thing of individual health, is that you can't spend $100 million on each one of us. You know. So we need to know that our tests are valid, and then allow time. If you just, you know, to keep getting clinical information. But this is a fantasy of mine. I don't know if it'll happen ever. We just hope it does. But getting back to the most important thing is bugs change our immune system. Okay, because that is what I think a lot of people don't get, is that when you have an infection, it's rarely the bug that's causing the problem. I mean, occasionally bugs produce toxins that kill us, you know, or destroy organs, you know, but most of the time it's our immune response that's destroying the organ, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, yeah, because if the virus keeps replicating in too many cells in your lungs and your liver and your heart, you're going to kill enough cells that, yes, you will die from that. But most of the time, it doesn't do that.
Most of the time, it's the cleanup crew that comes in with a bat.
Yeah, that starts killing and doesn't stop. I call it the Tony Soprano moment. You know, when he starts punching, he can't stop. You know, that's what hurts us, is our own inability to know that the war is over, to put it down, to relax. And that is, the problem of self-defense. When are you safe? You know, everything eats everything. So nothing is ever really safe in nature. I mean, I no offense. I mean, like, the people, I honor the people who want, you know, nature to, you know, life to be full of love and joy and take care of every living thing. But that's just not how the world works, unfortunately, and nature works. I mean, forget about us, but nature is constantly, every organism has to kill something, you know, to survive. Okay. The cost of that is an immune system and a defense system, and also a brain that's always watching for danger, you know. And we live in a culture where, because we can protect ourselves, I have to talk to a psychologist about this, where this flip is, you know, because you see people who live more in nature tend to be more relaxed. And I think it's not just because they're in the trees and on the earth, which helps a whole lot, but I just think their everyday confrontation with danger and lack of, and safety is more in their consciousness. You know, like, you worry when you see the thing, you know, like, well, and again, we don't have many large predators anymore, but, you know, when you're out there, you know, you're alert, but you're not anxious. And mm-hmm. we have created a world of ersatz safety, where that never goes down. And I think that does contribute to the autoimmunity in the system. You know, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. I have anxious genes by nature. You know, so I don't think, and I think that reflects in my immune system. It's just like it is always, you know, it's quietly wary. You know,
it is. I have quite a bit of training now in trauma responses and nervous system changes after trauma, mm-hmm. and like fear and anxiety and somatic therapies. And according to my understanding of how a lot of that works, is if something happened, this is, it's really parallel to the immune system, kind of, in my understanding of it. If something happened that traumatized us or scared us or was too big to handle at the time, that gets stuck. Like the fear, the terror, like you're a child, you can't process it, you can't feel it. So it goes somewhere and then it lives there. A lot of people now believe it lives in the fascia. And so that it's like an energetic thing that gets stuck in the fascia, which causes a constriction, which inhibits communication, because they think that the fascia is like a quantum communication network. We're going to get way crazy if I go too into it, but
it gets stuck there.
So then that still is there. So then there is this subconscious. You mentioned like you're not conscious of it. So it like there's this unconscious fear that exists and you're not conscious of it at all. So it's driving this physical sensation of fear, and the mind is really good at trying to make sense of things and trying to explain things. So if the body feels this fear that you're not conscious of, the mind will find things to be scared of, like this is going to happen, that's going to happen, this thing, blah, blah, blah. And it's those people with those running thought processes of like these million bad things are going to happen, is the brain trying to make sense of the thing it doesn't know how to explain. And once those things are made conscious, like I have this fear because of that, and you can work to like process those things or finish the unfinished emotional expression or the unfinished danger response, it subsides. And then the mind won't have to go and find 27,000 things to be attacking or scared of or vigilant on or whatever. I think the immune system, I don't know if that even made sense. I've never really explained it in that way before, but what you're saying about the immune system like reminded me of that.
Well, I think it's exactly that. I mean, to me, it is exactly that.
It leaves an echo.
And you keep looking for what is, I mean, when the immune system gets overly amped up, it keeps looking for problems.
Like, you know, even after that bug is gone.
Yeah. Because it needs the signal from the brain to stand down. At the end of the day, the brain runs everything. I mean, I know people, but it does. It can't fix everything, but it can screw everything up.
But if it never gets the signal, if the immune system never gets the signal to stand down, it's going to be looking for that thing or anything that looks like that thing forever.
It's just suddenly you have a jumpy police force,
everyone's on edge, like
everyone is on edge, and you start attacking things that you shouldn't attack. This whole thing of autoimmune disease is another world.
We can't get into that. We got to wrap it up. We're at an hour. That's a whole nother hour.
It's basically the same. To me, it's all the same thing. Is autoimmunity is the same thing. It's just inflammation that has it. Your brakes stop working on one part of the immune system. And we see it with age, is our ability to regulate our immune function, our ability to turn it up when we need it. Okay, our ability to recognize new threat diminishes, and we often stay focused on the old stuff that's not important anymore. Okay, I mean, one of the markers for aging of an immune system is antibodies to cytomegalovirus, which is and because there's something, and nobody quite understands, at least I don't, and I've looked at it, I don't think anybody quite understands why in a lot of people those antibodies go, and they're ineffective, they're not useful for anything, but you start making more and more of them. And I mean, that's why the COVID vaccine had such a hammer to it, is because it was designed for old people, and old people, their Tregs don't work well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's why everybody's taking rapamycin now, is to try to get those Tregs working again. And so they can help your body discriminate when it's time to stop the fight, you know? So the structure part, I just want to go back, because I love the structure part. And I think that's so crucial, when people have been ill for a while, And that's what really what we're focusing on. We'll come back to the people we really care about here are the people who've been ill for a while. Okay. And as we said before, when you're really sick, you're not taking out the garbage and the toxins and the just byproducts, the waste products of daily life begin to get stuck into that connective tissue, the same place where, like, you know, the people who work with trauma can feel the thickening in the connective tissue. Well, that's once that starts happening, the garbage builds up even more because that thickened area is not getting good lymph drainage or blood flow or nerve input. I mean, that's why, you know, I feel that, you know.
It's almost like a hologram with all these different layers, and the thing that's stuck impacts every.
Oh, I like that.
Like the fascia being whatever word you want to call it, rigid. It not only holds from the trauma side of things, the energy or the emotion or the more esoteric kind of non-tangible thing that you don't think of in medicine, but then in medicine, that same tissue that's contracted or tense or tight is going to alter the nerves that go through there. It's going to stop the lymph from going through there. It's going to affect organs that are nearby. People don't realize that fascia actually goes through every single thing. It's not just around muscles. It's like through everything. So it would impact. Yeah, it would impact anything that's in that area, which then causes physical disease, physical symptoms, like physical biochemical changes. And so people say, how can an emotional thing cause a biochemical change? It's not just the hormones and the neurotransmitters that happen around hormones. It's the fascia.
Your muscle, you know, muscle tone changes, restricts motion, fascia. Mm-hmm. I mean, like your lymph and your fascial system need to be massaged. They need that motion to stay healthy. And that's, you know, that's one of the things that adds to this chronic illness is that when you have a dysautonomia or you just have fatigue.
No, you can't move.
So you can't move. And, you know, movement is restricted. And that just
not
allows
moving makes you more sick
to build up in the system. Yeah. You have to flush, you know, all of our systems biology, you know, ecology, you know, they all those worldviews are biology, you know, and today everybody talks about systems biology, but hardly anybody still uses it. You know, I mean, everybody, you know, it's a great, you know, great buzzword.
That can be said about a lot of things in this culture on a lot of levels.
Yes, yes. We have the right
Everybody likes to talk about a lot of things.
Yeah, but well, because doing them, you know, because again, this goes back. We are amazing engineers. I mean, that's what our brain does really well is be an engineer. A causes B. You fix A, it's going to have an effect on B, and you know what? You can, you know, move levers and get things going. Our brains don't do well with complexity. You know, it's just some of us are wired that we kind of get a kick out of it. You know, you and I get a dopamine rush from complexity.
Yeah, I find it interesting.
it makes me happy. Okay, but you know, other people get happy when they can organize stuff and get everything lined up in a very nice pattern, you know, a simple pattern that's beautiful.
But I acknowledge this.
Yeah, right. No, I mean, so that's part of the beauty.
I'm married to one of them.
Yeah, and as we said in the beginning, we need both. We need the people who really want everything lined up because they will, and then we need people who want to mix all those nice lines into weave them into something that's a meta level, a different level, but without the people lining the information up, people like you and I are going to
be a mess.
We're going to be like arguing like arguing about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. We'd have a good time, but we wouldn't accomplish much.
Yeah, it'd be more philosophy than anything practical.
Right, which is kind of where we are right now. But it's what I love because you see, these thought patterns help me and help the doctors I work with when we look at the patient and we've got the linear information, you know, that this test is high and that test is low, but that's nice. You know, your gut is a mess. But the question is your gut a mess mean that, okay, if we give you the right drug or herb and remove something, is it going to go back to more balanced state? Or is your gut a mess, but your nervous system is such a mess that if we try to monkey directly with your gut right off, we're just going to make it mess.
Yeah, and then it's going to go right back or stay. Or
we're just going to get, and also it'll get worse, mm-hmm. You know, is because, you know, once that gut is in a real inflammatory state, a real self-defensive state, okay, any information that gets in there just reinforces the danger. You know, I don't want to bring politics in it, but it really is that, you know, when one person's reassurance is another person's, oh my God, I really got to worry about that. It's just how the systems work. So it's so important when you're confronted by, you know, people who are chronically ill to line up all the information you can and then step back and look at the picture and go, okay, you know, the gut is a mess, but, you know, the diaphragm is totally stuck. This person, besides not breathing, they're not massaging their gut. Their pelvis is locked up. So right there, these two big muscles, like when you know, remember when you walk and you feel your calf tighten up? Well, that's pump. We all understand that that's pumping and getting the blood and the gunk out of there. Well, if your diaphragm, if your diaphragm and you're below your lungs and your pelvic diaphragm is locked up, well, then you're depriving your intestines and your liver and your pancreas of a lot of motion, which is helping keep them clean as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's this critical thinking. And that way you can step back and realize that, oh, well, maybe I should deal a little bit with the structure or the emotions. You know, you don't have to spend years doing this, but you got to pay it. You got to start there. And then you might have a lot more luck with the gentle interventions in the gut because you'll begin to get it. You'll begin to get some safety signals into the gut because, you know, everyone says, like, you know, the largest collection of nerves is in the, you know.
People have no idea how common that is. Like you mentioned diaphragm contraction or tight or restricted or like pelvic floor or hips or pelvis. The biodynamic breathwork that I'm trained in uses manual therapy in addition or self massage if it's on the person doing it themselves or if I'm present with somebody. There's different techniques. You notice this in people's breathing that their belly will go out, but then their lower ribs won't expand at all when they're breathing, or vice versa, or there's disjointed. If you just tell a person without giving them any instruction at all, take a deep breath, and then you watch 10 people do this, they're all going to breathe differently. They're all going to have constriction in some spot, and the diaphragm is almost as common as the psoas and the hip flexors and the hips as being tight. And one actually runs through the other one, sort of, so then they're related. And there's a trauma response, like a physical trauma response that is curling, like is curls the body. That's like a fetal position. Picture somebody going in a fetal position from standing, kind of kind of to protect the belly. When you get startled or scared or afraid or any of these things, there's like a, that does that a lot. And then it stays like that. And there's a million other reasons why it gets like that, but it is so common. It is so common that the tightness and the pain of like working through someone's diaphragm when it's the fingers under the rib cage kind of situation. Whoa. And people can practice this. You can put your fingers under your rib cage and on an exhale, just kind of like round yourself into it a little bit and let your body weight like go over your fingers right under your rib cage. It is not, I've done it a lot, so I can do that without wincing, but for a lot of people, it is not enjoyable, and you can't even get the fingers in there, and it's so, so tense and tight, and people think the diaphragm is just for breathing, but everything you just said, like, I don't mean to go on these side rants, but it's like, people don't understand that it does so much more than breathing, and most adults in the U.S., it doesn't even do the breathing anymore. Like it's stationary. It's a stationary thing that's supposed to be going like a wave, and instead it stops, and anything that stops moving dies. Like
eventually. We have the same model, but I want people to understand the beauty of the body is that it can be so screwed up and you can still be okay.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't have to fix everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is because it can seem overwhelming, you know, especially when you've been, I mean, when you've been ill a while and mm-hmm. the energy flow is, well, what do I do? Where do I start? How much can I do? And the amazing gift of life is that it is, there's so much resiliency in the mm-hmm. system that you just work on pieces of it. For a lot of people, I mean, there are unfortunate a few folks who you got to fix everything, you know.
Yeah.
But most of us walking around, you just work on pieces, and if you keep going at it, you'll just feel better and better. It's not like you have to do everything today,
which allows you to do more stuff.
Yeah, right.
Like which allows you to do more of the pieces.
More of the pieces because your energy is better,
yeah.
and you're more resilient, and you're ready to.
Snowball, a reverse snowball effect.
It's an upward spiral, as we'd say, you know. Mm. And but the musculoskeletal system is one that we need to pay attention to. It is the beginning. It's all the beginning. You know, I mean, again, I was talking about
it
just started. It is a circle. So you can start with your mind. You can start with your immune system. But if you don't pay any attention to your musculoskeletal system, the structure, the fascia, you're going to be pushing uphill. You're going to mm-hmm. be working a lot harder. It doesn't mean you can't get better. I mean, I've seen people still get better who are a mess and never did anything with it. It's a lot more work, and there's a much better chance that you're going to wind up sick again. You know, it's just, and the modalities are endless. In fact, you could probably do a year of podcasts, and by the time of
I'm already planning on it. So
okay, of yeah. just different modalities, because you see the
for different forms of body work or fascial work or
right,
structural things or.
Yeah. There are so many ways. There are so many endless ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, that will work. I mean, like I had to cut
myself off from learning them because I would try something. Someone would do something on me, and I'd be, that was the coolest one. I need to learn how to do that. And then 3 weeks later, I'd have somebody else do something. I'd say, that was the coolest one. I'm going to learn how to do that. And there's not enough lifetimes to learn how to do.
And especially is that I always say it's the singer, not the song, is because, you know, two people can have the same training and yet one of them will just make your body happy and the other one didn't do much or made you work. And I always, I've said this last time we talked, I just want to emphasize, don't do a lot of it. If you're really sick and you've been, your body's
tiny bits,
tiny bits, because you will unload toxins, you will feel like crap. And if somebody treats you and you feel worse, don't say that hurt me. I mean, unless, you know, they did some high velocity thing where they tried to crack your back.
But it was just too much for me right now.
Yeah. If somebody's doing soft tissue work on you gently or cranial work, especially cranial, and you feel worse, you need to tell them and see if they can adjust, because, you know, or find somebody else who is better. Because how I rate how good people are when they're doing subtle body work is whether they can read my body in real time and not make people worse. The reason I don't do a lot of body work is I'm not that good. I was trained in osteopathy later on in life, and I was decent.
The subtlety of it is extreme.
Yeah, like, but I could hurt people because it felt so good to my hands and what was happening in their body. And in the moment, their body was very happy.
Yeah.
I didn't have the sensitivity, the depth of sensitivity to go, oh my God, we're moving more. I do not feel at a deeper level of where there's a little like, oh, this is too much, you know?
I had a screw up with this on me earlier this year. It was my first experience with nerve pain. I had a herniated disc, C5-6, and it was nasty. I was in the hospital. Like, I was bedridden for 9 days. I had like 9 out of 10. what I would have considered unfathomable prior to this experience levels of pain. And it was starting to get better. I had seen this osteopath, a traditional osteopath, a bunch of times, and it was like weeks later, it was starting to get better. I was probably down to like a 3 or 4 out of 10. He did this treatment on me. It felt great while he was doing it. I woke up the next morning and I was back to like a 7 or an 8. And I panic texted him like, what the hell, man? What happened? Whatever. And he said, I'm sorry. I probably went a little too fast with some of the adjustments I was trying to do because you seem to be doing so well. I misjudged where you were. He said, that will calm down in a day or two. Just don't do anything. Don't do these things. Yeah. And it'll calm down in a day or two. Come see me again in a couple of weeks and we'll go more careful with it. And I didn't not go see him because of that thing. I still believe in the modality. It was just he messed up from a subtlety standpoint and was like, oh, this guy's doing great. Let me turn the dial.
Yeah.
And the next morning, my body was like, actually, no, that was not the right play. And my arm couldn't lift anymore again. Yeah. And so it definitely happens. I think people out there expect practitioners, both doctors and body workers and whoever, to like nail it 100% every time.
No, people need to give us a lot of space. I mean, again, if you're having, your gallbladder removed, you know, or your or broken arm set, well, then you can, because then what they're doing is fairly standard. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they've done it 100 or 1,000, hopefully 1,000 times, you know, and, your anatomy is different on the inside. So yeah, with the surgery is always different, but it's gross enough skill set that it should be right on. But mm-hmm. when somebody's working with your connective tissue and you're sensitive, you got to give them some space and know that it's not easy, and you know, to read that. And it's the same thing with when you go see a practitioner and you're super reactive to stuff. Understand that no matter how careful you are and how you're going to make a mistake, people are going to get worse, and it's horrible. I mean, I hate it. The people who happens to hate it even more, but
yeah, it's never what's intended. It is awful to.
To be on either side of that, because mm-hmm. you know, the thing about the lovely thing about our profession is that we really are doing this because we enjoy helping people. Mm-hmm. You know, when people rail against the evil doctors and nurses, and I kind of think, yeah, wait a minute, no, these are good people. They might have done bad stuff to you, but rarely. I mean, there is always a bad apple, but very few people go into the healing professions just to make money and take advantage of people, you know?
Especially now with what they have to face to get their education.
Right.
So, nobody's going into $500,000 worth of debt just for shits and giggles. Like, there's always a...
Well, usually a calling that can be perverted in time. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm not saying that there's not bad, but just know that practitioners, you know, and anyone in a doctor's office, actually, even the front desk staff. I mean, well, we're really going off the note, but just a note here for the front desk staff. They are people who to work in a, if you just to have a job, there's a million easier jobs than dealing with sick, yeah. needy, pained humans,
unhappy, angry, yeah,
right, and on a daily basis,
it's like the pinnacle of customer service difficulty,
right? Because yeah. Because again, you're dealing with the doctor.
Everyone's having a bad day if they're in your office,
right? And and the doctor's going to do something that makes you not happy, and you don't want to get angry at the doctor. It's really easy to get angry at the front desk people. So try to remember that. Get angry at the doctor. Get angry at me. If there's a problem, blame it on me. To me, be nice to the people who are really there to help and to serve. And anyways, I'm going to.
We got to stop. We're at an hour something. And no, it's fantastic, though. It's so good. I'm probably even going to split this one into two parts. So you're going to be the first three-parter. but it's great. It's like a fire hose of information that I think that chronically ill people and practitioners need to hear and understand, because there's so much black and whiteness that exists in this world of like, I have this diagnosis, so I need to find somebody that fixes this problem, and then they're going to use their system that fixes this problem, and then it doesn't work. It works sometimes, but it doesn't always work. And then they go to the next person with the next system, and the next person with the, and then they land in your office, and they've been to 17 of those systems.
And the point is, and the good part is, it was usually they needed all of that. It just may be in a different order. And that's another thing to talk about one day, is order of treatment is the same thing with the body work. Order of treatment matters. You know, again, in really healthy people, it doesn't so much. You know, if they come in and your back's a little out, you can probably just start anywhere you want and you'll get away with it. But in somebody who's really has a chronic problem, if you adjust the sacrum before you fix the mid-back in that person, it might not work. You know, you're not going to get the result you want, because one thing stressed the other thing. And so the compensation, and it's all about compensation. Compensation is what keeps us ill. Anyway, Michael, I mean, talking to you,
super
we can do
fun.
It all day long.